Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Hey friends, so Facebook started this supporter option for creators on Facebook, and they reached out to us and asked us to try it out. And we have, and it's super fun.
Dude, it's been amazing. All this content that, you know, we always want to do anyways, but now we really get to do it and share it with our supporters. It's exclusive content.
It is.
You know, I do a Motivation Monday. You do Thirsty Thursday.
Yep. We share backstage stuff from tours. We shared a poolside chat that we had in a pool in Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah, it was hot.
Just stuff like that. And, you know, we try to give out a lot of content across social media, but there are some of you lovely folks that, you know, want more. And so this is for people that want to see more behind the scenes stuff, more lifestyle stuff, more things that are just kind of in the recesses of our brains.
Yeah,
that
we just released a song.
We just released a song
for supporters, which is amazing.
Supporters are the first to see it. Supporters get a permanent discount on Stone Cold and the Jackal merchandise. They get to be part of a private supporter group so that they can all talk to each other and talk with us. There are so many benefits to being a supporter. And if you're so inclined, we'd love to have you.
Yeah, go check it out on our Facebook page. There's a blue button. Click Become a Supporter and check out our new song. That's awesome.
That's awesome. Oh, dude, that's awesome.
That's awesome.
With Stephen Bradford.
Stevie B!
What's up, dude?
Hey, man. How are you?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
I'm so good. We have this beautiful tile view, and you look great. I look okay. But there is someone else included in this tile view.
Yes.
Handsome fellow.
Who we're very lucky to have.
Indeed. You guys are so excited. You guys have no idea how excited we are, and we can only speculate. But we can assume how excited you will be to hear from this man who you've loved for many, many years. Jonathan Jackson is with us here today.
Jonathan Jackson. I tracked him down.
Amazing. Thank you. Well, I feel lucky to be here with you all. So.
Oh, well, thanks, Jonathan.
Gosh.
Very sweet of you, man.
First of all, how's your day? Where are you? What else is in your day? Because see, I'm not sure how many people know what your daily life is like right now. So
that's true. That's true. Well, you know, it's I don't even know what my daily life is like right
how
now.
How exciting!
No, I'm currently in Nashville. You know, I've been here for the last 7 years, and it's been amazing. It's been great. But my daily life consists of any combination of music and writing and being with the family, you know.
Sounds pretty ideal.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. I mean, it's busy and great, you know, all of that. So,
yeah, yes. And those are two words that are, that are great.
Try to hang on, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so Johnny, before we jump into kind of General Hospital, you moved to Nashville to be on the show Nashville,
yes.
Obviously. So when you auditioned for that, where were you when you auditioned for Nashville?
I was in LA at the time, and you know, I had just been on General Hospital for the prior 2 years, right before Nashville came around, and it was interesting because you know, I've been doing music since I was very young. But I hadn't really done a project where music and acting were connected. So they asked me to bring a guitar and sing a couple songs. And I hadn't really ever done that before, interestingly enough. And in the same week, there was another show about a musician. And I ended up screen testing for both shows, Nashville and this other show. And Nashville moved my audition up one day prior to the other show. And so, you know,
circumstance, or were they thinking, hey, let's lock this guy in?
No, they were thinking, you know, they knew I was testing for this other show and they wanted to make sure they, they had the option. So I ended up booking Nashville and the other show, which was a cool script, but the pilot didn't get picked up.
Ah.
So it was a
good
real
choice.
Yeah, well,
lucky.
It was a blessing.
Hey, yeah. What song did you play in your audition?
Well, they just said pick whatever. So, you know, of course. Of course,
you picked a song no one's ever heard of.
No. No, I just, you know, I picked a song that would, you know, show a little bit of range and something I knew how to play really well. I think
was it one of your own?
No. I think I did Desire, the U2 song.
Oh, yeah.
Of course. And then I think I did One as more of a ballad thing.
Awesome.
That was your first audition singing.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you'd sang in front of people before, so it wasn't completely out of your comfort zone. It was just not something that you had ever done in that scenario.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was, yeah, I started performing when I was really young. I was probably 9 years old when I first performed on stage. And then as a teenager, I performed a lot on the Sunset Strip, you know, the Roxy and Whiskey A Go-Go. And I was,
wow,
it was pretty funny actually, because I was decked out, you know, in all black and a hat and leather pants and playing rock and roll music, you know, at 14 years old. I couldn't even, you know, go to the bar, obviously. I was too young to get into the clubs, but they let me play. So then I was doing, you know, both the Blue Sky and just old rock music. And my dad was the bass player. My uncle was the guitar player. My brother was the drummer. So it was like two generations of brothers. So I'd been playing music for years, but it just, the acting thing and music thing had never come together, and Nashville was that.
Well, it's interesting though, because when you're performing a song, it, you know, picking a song that has lyrics that you can play versus lyrics that are just things that you sing to. That,
yeah.
And that, what I loved about Nashville is that you guys kind of walk that line of, hey, we're singing to sing the song, but we're also playing these lyrics to either our scene partner, or so it was like part musical, yeah, part just musical performance.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And that was an interesting line that you guys kind of walked in. I think it made the music so much more organic in the show, rather than, okay, we're going to stop and just sing a country song here because these people sing country music. Yes. You guys really put it into the story. But not so much that it was like you're making coffee with your girlfriend and then you just start singing a song to her because that's so, but it was interesting, but it worked really well, obviously.
Yeah, I think one of the more unique things about the show was that it was original music, and it was coming from, you know, the soul of each character, so to speak. So you get to watch them go through this dramatic situation, and then the inner life of the character gets to come out in a unique song. And I think that was one of the things that people connected with, that was unique with the show.
Yeah. But Jonathan, you didn't end up singing country music. You kind of sang the rock and roll stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it worked out that way, which I was.
Do you know any country music at all? now you do.
I don't know very much country music after probably 1995.
Okay, there you go.
But I love classic country music. You know, my dad is a huge country music fan, so.
Yeah,
I grew up listening to Don Williams and Keith Whitley and Vince Gill and Alison Krauss, Garth Brooks.
That was your country.
That was my country thing. Yeah, I got into rock and roll as soon as I became, well, even before I was a teenager. But on the show, you know, T-Bone Burnett did the music for season one, and he keyed in on each of our musical sensibilities very quickly in the process. And Avery, you know, my character Avery Barkley, ended up being more of a rock and roll Americana. You know, there were a few people that were thrown around, mentioned, you know, musical influences like the Black Keys and
for you.
Yeah, for Avery. Yeah.
Yeah, like that. And, kind of, but who are your musical influences?
They range, but I'll rattle off a few. I mean, I grew up listening to a lot of REM, a lot of Peter Gabriel, a lot of U2's catalog from, you know, the 80s to the early 90s, especially. Leonard Cohen, huge Leonard Cohen fan. Johnny Cash, Echo and the Bunnymen. That's kind of the snapshot, I'd say, of the biggest influences.
Well, now that you mentioned Echo and the Bunnymen, so yeah. You know, it's interesting because obviously you were on General Hospital for a long time. You started very young. That's yeah. where you and I met in Bradford, yeah. and you spent a lot of your life there. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when people leave, sometimes a lot of fans don't know what's going on. I mean, right. fortunately, you got on a great show in Nashville, and you had a great 5-6 year run, whatever that was. Mm-hmm. But music has been so dominant in your life.
Yeah,
where I don't think people really know how much, you know, the music means to you, especially yeah. as an artist.
Yes.
And, you know, we just saw each other. We went to Disneyland mm-hmm. with our kids. We had a nice family trip for McKenna's 16th birthday. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about how Nashville went. You guys, a bunch of you on the show went on the road to the UK, right? To England? Yes. Or did you guys go – did you guys tour around? Did you – first of yeah. all, let's just start here. Did you guys do some U.S. dates, and then how'd you get to Europe, and yeah. then how'd you end up opening for Echo and the Bunnymen?
Yeah, you know, that was an amazing thing that happened with Nashville. The show is something I never foresaw, which was that they wanted to, you know, take us on the road.
Cool is that?
It's amazing. And Steve Buchanan in particular really spearheaded that, and it was amazing. So we did a few U.S. tours, I think maybe 3 years worth, and then they decided let's go overseas, and I think we did that probably for about 3 years as well.
So the show, they sold the show overseas too, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you guys had a big fan base, and I know what Sam is. He's from the UK. Yeah, right.
Yeah, he's from the UK. No, but it was crazy. I mean, the support of the fans overseas was just amazing. We played yeah. Royal Albert Hall a few
wow.
times. We
That's amazing.
O2 Arena, and we went all over the UK, which was such an incredible experience. You know, we went to Glasgow and Edinburgh. We went to Cardiff in Wales, Northern Ireland, and then also Dublin. So it was an incredible experience. And then out of that experience, you know, I performed at Royal Albert Hall and played an Echo and the Bunnymen song, which is for me one of the best songs ever, called "The Killing Moon." And "The Killing Moon" reminded me of something that T-Bone, you know, would have brought to me in terms of it's one of those songs that kind of transcends genres, and it sits in that Orbison space for me. So I played it, and somehow it reached Ian McCulloch of Echo and the Bunnymen, and I ended up going over with E-Nation and doing a few tours with Echo and the Bunnymen, and that was just an incredible experience on so many levels. It was really, really exciting.
Wow.
That's amazing. I mean, we're talking to a real rock star now, not this Pork Chuck stuff, Bradford.
No, I know. I know.
That's amazing.
It's funny, Jonathan. We, you know, we hearken back to those days all the time because people ask us about us a lot, and
it was
such a novelty for us. But to talk to someone like yourself, who's it's such like a fixture in their life and has been and when it's a fixture of your life, you know, there's intimate moments with it, and then there's moments where you're opening it, you know. So it's just a part of your life in such a way that's different, obviously, from the way it connected to us. So it's fun to hear about it, for sure.
No, it's amazing. I mean, O2 Arena, that's got to fit. That's got to at least seat 15,000 people.
Yeah, yeah, that was
that's crazy, dude. Yeah,
that was
so cool.
That was an amazing moment. Another really amazing moment for me on that on the Nashville tour was there was a couple, but one was. In Glasgow, I got to perform a Simple Minds song, "See the Lights," and they were a really huge influence as well. And then in Belfast, I got to perform their song "Belfast Child," which had meant a lot to me ever since I was probably 14 years old. So that was very special to actually be in Belfast and
perform that
song. Yeah.
That's really cool, man. That's really cool. I know when you were gracious enough to stand in for Scott when we did Port Chuck in Nashville, mm-hmm. We were like, yeah, this guy's never singing with us again.
Hey, man, that was fun.
We did have some fun.
To perform, you know, speaking of that, I think I did a Simple Minds song.
You did? Yeah, yeah. And REM, I think.
Yeah.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun.
No, I got to do some songs I'd never been able to perform before. So that was cool.
Yeah, it was cool.
And for me, Jonathan, it was, you know, I had heard you sing maybe on the show or on GH, I mean. And
yeah, there were a couple.
Yeah. And you sang those songs from just like a very, you know, quiet, thoughtful place. And obviously you're not going to wail on TV. I'm not sure the sound works that well. Yeah. But so yeah. I had no feel. And then you came up and, you know, you have an amazing ability to take a song that people know incredibly well and truly make it your own. Mm-hmm. And you know, your vocal abilities are unique as well. You know, like some of the sounds that you make that are organic to your resonance are specifically yours, and it's a real treat. So when we were singing in you guys' restaurant in Franklin, and all of a sudden you're just like, it feels like an event every time you sing. And so that was really special to be a part of.
Yeah. We'll give you one more compliment.
Yeah, I know. And then we're done. That's it. I'm keeping track of the quota of compliments we've got. Yeah.
So right. one more until we start talking about your acting.
Yeah.
Anybody who's never heard Jonathan sing, which I'm sure you have to Google him at the Opry singing Unchained Melody. It's unbelievable.
It is.
I'll tell you.
YouTube that. Go ahead.
I'll tell you a really interesting story with all of that, which is, you know, I mentioned my dad sings country music, and that's the first time I ever performed was with him on stage. And so it was a surreal thing to suddenly be on the Opry stage because
that's amazing place.
It was so nostalgic for me. It reminded me of my childhood, and you know, to me, it's like this is my father's music. This belongs to him, you know, more so than it does to me. So, the first song I ever performed there was an Elvis gospel song called "You'll Never Walk Alone," and I dedicated it to my dad. And then a few years after that, this was probably maybe even last year, I can't remember. He was coming in to visit me in Nashville, and we got to perform together on the Opry stage. And
wow,
that was a really special moment for us. And he got to sing "Glory, Glory, Hallelujah," the Elvis gospel song, and you know, belt it out on the Opry stage.
That's amazing. Yeah, I know Steve Buchanan, right? He was executive producer of Nashville, but he also is what at the Opry?
Well, he kind of ran the Opry for many years.
Yeah.
He stepped away from that a year or two ago. But
he did. Okay.
Yeah, but he was.
But I thought it was so smart that he'd bring you guys up because I saw you perform there a few times.
Yeah.
And the Opry, if you've never been to the Opry, man, it is amazing. It's just something really spiritual and just magical about the place. It's just great. It's just, I've never been to a place and felt that way before.
Yeah.
And it's just so cool that you guys were able to do that. So are you a member of the Opry?
Oh, I know. I have no idea how that happens.
I think if you played there enough, right?
we've played there a lot over the last six, seven years. But, no, I was just, you know, I think it's a combination of the history that's there.
Yeah.
They do such a good job of keeping the history alive and then also having, you know, newer artists. And I don't know, I feel the same way. I mean, every time I go there, there's just something really special about it, you know?
Oh man, it was amazing.
Kind of an intangible thing, but
yeah. How do the sets work there? Because it seems like every time I watch footage, there seems to be like a full orchestra. I mean, so is it like when you sang Unchained Melody, was that part of a set or did you just come out and sing that one song or how does it work?
Usually each performer does about two songs, sometimes three, depending on the show. And that's one of the things that just keeps it moving all the time because, you know, you never know what's going to come next. But one of the interesting things about the Opry is there's no sound check on stage. You just rehearse backstage in a room and then you go out there and you just do it.
That's amazing. Wow.
You know, so every time you go out there, you don't quite know exactly what it's going to sound like or feel like. And you just, and the musicians are just, I mean, to me, they're geniuses. I don't know
how. So they're house musicians. They're there. They are belong to the Opry and they play every show.
Well, they have a few that rotate, but there are central musicians that play, you know, every week there. And these are some of the best musicians in the world. They chart a song and then pretty much just play it.
Unbelievable. That's so cool.
And they put their own, you know, soul and creativity into it every time. And it's been amazing. I mean, you know, Steve was joking about that I don't know any country music, and there's some truth to that. but, you know, so over the last however many years, I've looked at the Opry and gone, okay, how can I bring music that is really coming from me that connects with this musical history? And so, you know, I've been able to bring, you know, Elvis songs, Orbison songs, and I've gone as out there, I guess, as doing Peter Gabriel at the Opry, you know, even Pearl Jam, you know, the Bunny Man.
And they don't have any like qualifications, like you sing what you want, or do you have to check it with somebody or what?
No, I mean, they've never, you know, I try my best to be as respectful to the place as possible. And so far I have never received a slap on the wrist, so right. to speak. So,
right.
You know, like,
you sure you want to do this song, son?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So can you get me in to sing Ice Ice Baby or no?
Hey, you know, if you turn it into a ballad, Steve,
sure.
You never know. Oh, you know, put some steel guitar and a banjo. And I mean,
yeah, banjo with Ice Ice Baby. That'd be amazing.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. That's awesome, dude. What a huge opportunity. I mean, what a like whole separate almost career.
Yeah.
From getting Nashville till today, you know?
No, yeah. The live music part of it, performing at the Opry and then the tours, has been really, I think for me personally, some of the most, the biggest blessing really of.
Yeah. So I know you've performed in front of people before, obviously, musically. How do you compare that to, because, you know, we're doing these live shows and we're not comparing that to the O2 arena by any means, but, you know, having a live performance is so much different than doing what we grew up doing, you know, whether it's film or, you know, daytime.
Yeah.
So what would you, you know, liken that to? Is there a preference? Is it just, or is it just different for you, or do you prefer one or the other?
Yeah, no, it is. It's strange because, and you know this from all the different kinds of performing you do as well, is I think there are similarities, you know, there with any kind of performing. You know, there's the element of, I guess, maybe paradox of preparation and also being open and available to the moment that you don't know what's going to happen. And that tension is there, whether it's an acting scene, a live musical performance, or any of those kinds of things. One of the things I love about General Hospital is, for me, performing in that medium is kind of almost like an amalgamation of theater and film, you know, because you really are performing it live. You know, the editing is happening in the moment. They're in the booth switching cameras and you're just performing the scene. And if all goes well, you just do one take.
Right, yeah.
Right.
You know? And so there is a certain feeling of that's much closer to stage performing. And you get more of that instant sense of, okay, that was the scene, that's what we did, and that's it. That's closer to performing live. But the difference is when you're performing live with music, there's an audience there, and there's this reciprocal, there's this energy and synergy that takes place. And, you know this, I'm assuming, but most people that experience that, it's pretty hard to beat that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure is.
Because
sure
I think there's just something so wired in us, in our humanity, to experience a creative event together, you know? And when you feel the possibility of whether it's humor and laughter or whether it's, you know, something more deep and emotional, whatever the connection is, when you feel the potential for that to take place with the audience, you're experiencing it as well, you know?
Absolutely.
Film is the most, I would say, tedious out of all of them.
Yeah.
You know, and I do love the process, but it's not, there's very little instant gratification with film. It's like building a house brick by brick, and then a year later you'll get to see it, and maybe you'll like how it turned out, maybe not. You know, with
right.
how the editing went. So
and I, going back to, you know, talking about GH, talking about Nashville, like the kinds of shows that you can do on TV. I'm not sure if you've ever done a procedural, you know, I'm sure maybe a guest star or something, but mm-hmm. like talking about the ins and outs of a crime versus yeah. like having an emotional connection with a family member, or like on soaps, we have all those things, all those moments where you really connect with people, and there can be yes. satisfaction in that. And on, you know, in Nashville was a soap of sorts, right? A nighttime soap yeah. of sorts, right? Yeah. So there was a lot of, you know, you were connecting with your scene partner in a way that afterwards you're like, you could probably feel, oh, we accomplished something. And that yes. was, we connected yes. and that was, but you know, some yeah. people, you know, if you're doing a police show and you're just, there are less of those moments. And so so I can see where there could be some exhaustion for those people. You know, cause you're right. You're just, yeah. you're putting a puzzle together, but there may not be much more satisfaction other than, oh, well, we got through the day. Cause like, yeah. creatively, I don't know what you get out of that as yeah. much as I know what I feed off of as an actor, yes. which is that connection with the scene partner.
But yeah. but that is a double-edged sword, though, in a way, Bradford, because if you do have the – like if you're on a show where you are having to carry emotion, you know, the great thing for us on GH is, mm-hmm. hey, I know I got four or five emotional – I got an emotional scene run today, four or five scenes, right? Mm-hmm. And I know it's going to be at around 1 p.m.
Yeah.
So I can mentally almost start preparing – mm-hmm. you know, like, okay, 11:30 comes around. I'm going to start kind of gearing up, preparing. I'm going to be able to go on stage, no interruptions. We're going to go right through those four or five scenes, one, two takes max. And we're going to get our result right there and be like, okay, great. We did it.
Yeah.
But if it's emotional stuff all the time, I just don't personally, as an actor, I don't want to, I'd almost rather do a procedural and yeah. then have your occasional
emotional
stuff, because yeah. I don't want to have to carry it. Like, yeah. I mean, there was some stuff that you guys did in the first couple seasons that was pretty heavy and pretty, I mean, just to, cause I, you know, I was there in Nashville yeah. with you and you're like, man, this is just beating me up, because yeah. you have to carry it for every day for seven yeah. or 8 days. And that's no fun. I mean, yeah. it is fun because we chose to do it.
Right.
But if you're doing it week after week after week after week, yeah. then it could get a little bit of a,
yeah.
I need a break.
Yeah, no, it's true. It is a double-edged sword. I mean, I've talked to people that have had more of the experience of the procedural, and they are longing to do more what Bradford was describing. And then on the other side, you know, because of all the years on General Hospital with very heavy emotional material, and I had done about 2 years, what to me felt like 2 years solid of that almost before yeah. Nashville. So I kind of came into Nashville a bit, you know,
burnt out, a bit depleted.
And so there were moments where I thought, wow, wouldn't it be nice to kind of just walk into an office and try to solve a case and totally. Be a little detached, you know?
Absolutely.
But I'm sure if I did 6 years on that, I would be like, come on, let's do something here. Let's, you know.
Right.
Sure. I know.
So, yeah.
We're so spoiled. I know.
Balance, you know? Well, and it is, it's, we're spoiled, but at the same time, I think as artists, we kind of exist in this place of, we have a finite thing inside of us of what we can give out without, you know, being recharged, and we don't really understand how all that works. And so we are a bit fickle.
Yeah.
So sure. So from what you've said, you clearly have artistry in your family and creativity in your family, but you're not from you're not necessarily from New York or LA, right? So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Washington State in the Northwest.
Okay.
And acting and Los Angeles, New York, any of that was the farthest thing that we could have ever imagined.
So how did you find it?
Well, it was an interesting kind of, I don't know. We took a family vacation to Universal Studios. I was about 9 years old. And my brother and I, Richard is in the band E-Nation with me, and he's an actor as well. And he's 3 years older than me. So he was called out of the audience to sit in the DeLorean at the Back to the Future exhibit when they were showing, you know, how they filmed the flying car and everything. And, you know, at that time, I think they had the Backdraft exhibit and all sorts of stuff. But we went home just lit up about filmmaking and all that stuff. So we started making home movies together.
Oh.
And begged our parents to, you know, let us take acting classes. And so we did for a couple years, and then my parents were crazy enough and kind enough to take us to LA. My mom went down with us for probably, you know, they thought it was going to be a 3 or 4 month experiment, and then we'd move back home. And my dad, you know, works. Awesome. He still has a family practice in Washington State. I booked General Hospital within 4 months or so of being in LA.
How did you get just the practicalities of coming from Washington State, moving down to LA? Like, did you guys know, have relationships, or how did?
Yeah. Well, basically, I think the chain of events was my brother did a modeling and talent and modeling and acting competition in the Northwest. There was a manager there that got interested in him, and then he went to LA, and I just came down kind of, you know, I'd done the acting classes for a couple years as well in Portland. We both got the same agent and just started auditioning.
I see. Okay.
And,
wow.
And then I got General Hospital, and then he got Saved by the Bell.
Yeah, he was on Saved by the Bell for a little while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
3 years. So, you know, the 3 month experiment turned into
a lifetime.
Just never stopped.
It never stopped.
It never ended. But, you know, there was a lot of sacrifice on my parents' part. And that, you know, that was a huge thing.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, you can book a show here and there, but you booked something that you were put on a yearly contract, is my guess, right?
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting because a very similar thing happened that I mentioned earlier, where I screen tested for Nashville and another pilot at the same week.
Right. Yeah.
So weird how these things happen, you know, because you can go through times where, you know, you're just saying, "What am I doing? What's the next situation?" But when I booked a General Hospital, I also booked at the exact same time a primetime series that had a really huge established producer connected to it. And I basically had to decide which show I wanted to do.
Wow.
And I was only 11 at the time. And my parents said, you choose. So,
you choose.
Yeah.
What?
So, you know, obviously, you know, the primetime thing, on one hand, you can look and go, oh, it's primetime. It's with this huge, you know, executive producer. And I don't really know why. I just felt like I was supposed to do General Hospital. And mm-hmm. I don't really know why that was the case, but and I think that show only lasted one season.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Again, it was
good choice.
The training and, you know, that's even not putting enough weight into it. You know, I mean, gosh, my life, my childhood is connected with General. I met my wife, you know, on General Hospital. Just all the relationships that I have there. I'm so thankful that was the decision that I made.
You know? Do you remember, because you were how old when you booked it? 14?
11.
11, 11.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember, like, the difference in your life as an 11-year-old and how that, did you long for, was it just so exciting that you didn't think about what you left, or was there, what was that transition like?
In terms of what I left, like in Washington State, you mean?
Yeah,
be a regular kid.
There's so much naivety at
that time.
It's like, you don't really know. And I, you know, one of the things I'm grateful for is because I started so young, I didn't really have a concept of notoriety or any kind of fame, let's say. So I was just fascinated by the process of it. I was very curious and interested in the process of acting and filmmaking. And so that was really my focus. I don't think I really remember feeling overly torn about what I was leaving behind, but there was a 3-year period, I think, after I started General Hospital where I struggled with, you know, just being out in public and, you know, being at a restaurant and just knowing a lot of people recognize you, you know, as a young kid, that's a tough age anyway, from 11 to, you know, 16.
Right. Yeah.
It's a tough age anyway. So to know that people that you don't know are recognizing you and everything, it took me a few years to adjust to that. But I remember when it changed, you know, there was a moment, I think I was maybe 14 or so. And I just realized, I thought, you know, I just realized that I needed to stop looking at it from a kind of narcissistic perspective and realize that, you know, when people come up, and because 99% of the time, they're so gracious and kind. It's like, I'm just very introverted. So it was a tough transition for me. But, you know, I realized that it's not about me, you know, and this is a moment that it can bring some joy into someone else's life. And that kind of changed
pretty,
at that
pretty
point,
astute, you know? For a 14-year-old.
Well, it was, I think I had to, you know, I had to figure it out, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You know, Steve and I talked on a couple episodes back about like the Stranger Kids thing, the Stranger Things kids, and how they're going kind of through their awkward stage on television. Yeah, so and I'm not saying you had an awkward stage.
No, but it was there for everyone to see.
Right. But I mean, 13, 14, that's kind of full blown awkward phase, right? For most, right. That those junior high years, I mean, you know, some of us are still waiting to get out of ours. But you know, those years, and you spent them on television, so that the self-consciousness of like either that is negated by the people like me because I'm on TV, or it's like amplified. Oh my god, millions of people are watching me and I feel terrible. So, and I'm, you know, it's different for everybody, but how did that work for you?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, I don't think I've ever met an adult where if you ask them, hey, would you like to go back to that time, that anyone has said, oh yeah, I'd love to go back, you know? So that's,
well, you know, I was on a sitcom in the 80s and I would love to go back to that time.
Yeah, well, there's that.
Okay, well, you're the first one I've met, Steve.
Right.
Well, it wasn't my childhood, thank God, so.
Okay, well, that's different. But I mean, I'm talking about those years, let's say.
Oh, sure, sure.
12 to, you know, 16 or something like that.
Yeah.
No, it was difficult. I will say that there's something cathartic about art, you know? And for me, you know, I started writing songs when I was 11 and I'd been playing guitar since I was about 8. So I would be in my dressing room at General Hospital and just writing songs. And I think that was just key for me to be able to, it was like therapy. Just to have an outlet.
Yeah.
And you know, my son, my oldest is 16 and he's been playing piano for a long time. And I can see that in him, you know, if he's having a bit of a tough day, he goes to the piano and just plays for an hour, and I can tell it's very healing.
And he's a writer too.
Yes. And he writes. That's right. Yeah.
And exactly. So do you.
Yeah. Yeah.
How many books have you written?
Oh, I mean, I think two have been published, and then there's another probably three or four that are, you know, waiting to release at some point.
Yeah.
But all of that for me is just, it's therapeutic, you know. It's something that, it's a way to cope and get through things. And doing school and a full-time job that has heavy emotional content.
Yeah.
While you're trying to grow up and figure out who you are and all that stuff, it's a potentially dangerous recipe.
Right.
Well, yes, and we've seen the result many times.
Gosh, yeah.
Not a good one.
Yeah. So when you started writing music as a kid, do you remember that coming out of you like that? Because I mean, you learn to play guitar. Not everybody that learns how to play guitar writes, right? It's like it's a different part of your brain.
Yes.
And also writing books. And do you write fiction or nonfiction, or what?
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been experimenting with both. Yeah.
So you're a storyteller. Mm-hmm. And that, has that always been, have you always had stories, things that are just trying to get out of you? Is that something that's always, I mean, it sounds like at 8 you were doing it. So that's amazing.
I think that initially it was probably some kind of rage that was trying to get out of me. That's probably where it started. You know, it's interesting, like my most rebellious years emotionally and psychologically were probably from 8 to 12. You know,
it's better than probably than,
yeah.
Right?
Well,
18 to 22, you can get into a lot more trouble when you're 18 to 22.
That's true. No, but I'm the youngest of three, and I think I had some, you know, youngest person.
Hear me, see me. Stuff.
Yeah, and just always feeling a bit behind, you know, not being able to do certain things that other people, you know, my older siblings were doing, and all of that, and so there was a lot of rage, I guess, and anger in me. And so the first part of the storytelling wasn't really story. It was as much as the emotional need to kind of just get it out, you know? And then pretty early on, I would say I was about 12 years old. My brother was 15. And for whatever reason, we decided to start writing screenplays. And so I think that's when story really, you know, came into my worldview, which is this wonderful experiment of telling stories. And he and I have been writing together, you know, ever since, really. And then the screenwriting, I think that was probably a good 8 years of screenwriting before I started wanting to look into books and writing books. And the poetry came from songwriting. I'd been doing that for, you know, 10 years. And I started to get impatient with the, how limited a song is. You know, there's such little space where you can, you know, and so I thought, you know what, I've been doing this for so many years. I want to write some poetry with that. I don't have any constraints to it. I don't have to worry about even rhyming or verse meter. I can just, you know, just write more streams of consciousness stuff. And that was really therapeutic for me. That little book was Book of Solace and Madness, which we put out a few years ago. And that just, I don't know, that opened up a lot for me as well. I think that paved the way for fiction writing. Was it just experimenting? It's all a big experiment. I don't, you know, I never claim to know what I'm doing in any acting, music, writing, anything. It's just an experiment.
So when you started with GH, I mean, you were basically with Tony and Jeannie from day one, right?
Yes. Yep.
How, I mean, that you could, I mean, come on, dude. Like, this is, you couldn't have two better people to be your parents.
I know.
On television.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that was, to me, that's one of the most, that's something that I'm eternally grateful for on so many levels. You know, I mean, that I felt like a little sponge kind of, and all I was doing was just soaking up what they were doing. You know, you know, and acting is such a wonderful artistic medium because, you know, we all know this, but it's just, you listen and you watch and what the other person does changes everything about what you do. And Tony and Jeannie, they were like the perfect combination because Jeannie was just so, and she is, she's emotionally so present and so open and so vulnerable.
Still.
Yeah. And it's mind boggling. And so, you know, and as a child, I think children have an advantage because, you know, you're still very raw and vulnerable yourself and open. So when you're in the presence of somebody that's right there in that way, it's very powerful, you know, it affects you. And then Tony, he has that as well, but he also has this kind of madness, you know, to the way he approaches his work. And there's such wit and contradiction and paradox and mystery and everything he's doing. So the combination of the two of them was just, you know, such a gift.
Hey there. So we loved talking to Jonathan Jackson, so much so that we talked to him for about an hour and a half. So we decided to break it up into two parts. So you just finished part one. Congratulations. Part two will be next week. Part two is beautiful. We get into talking about his approach to acting, his approach to being a human. So we talk about compassion and empathy and go to some really, really lovely places. And breaking news, you guys, our wonderful listeners, will get a sneak peek of Jonathan's brand new single. So we're very excited to be able to share that with you. So don't miss part two next Wednesday. So after we get off the line with Jonathan, Steve told me a story about a time that he went to the Opry to see Jonathan, and he shares that with me. So here's that.
So at the Opry one time,
yeah,
we were at the Opry, and he sang, I think it was a U2 song that he sang, and he's so good, and his range is amazing, and he's pitch perfect. Remember, that's what the band said. I don't know if they said it to you, but to me, they were like, we've never, it was Andy and Jay and Dickie And I can't remember if Brian was there or not, but oh, I think Brian was, but together or at some point, two of them at a time were like, we have never worked with somebody who's more pitch perfect.
Yeah.
Like effortlessly, you know,
he's got an incredible ear. And,
yeah. But so he sang, I wasn't sure what to, you know, the Opry, I went to the Opry for the first time. It was amazing. If you ever go do the backstage tour, it's so cool. Oh, okay. You know,
it's not just available for guys on General Hospital.
It could be.
Okay.
We might be able to get you in there, but,
so is it still available to recurring people too?
Yeah. You're the jackal, bitch.
I'll say that.
Yeah. I'm the jackal, bitch. Let me in. So we're sitting in the audience I don't know what he's going to do. You know, we had a bunch of country music people on before, and then Jonathan comes up and he sings and, you know, people are going there to see country music.
Right.
Right. They're there. Sometimes they're going to see a top 10 guy. They might see a number one guy. They might see a number 50 guy. They might see someone who was big in the 90s.
Sure.
You know, it's just
and it's not listed. Like there's no,
sometimes it's listed, but sometimes there's so many spots, you know,
how many nights a week do they do it?
I think it's almost every, I don't know. I don't want to talk out of school cause I don't know.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's often,
but you like,
it's
so
not just Friday, Saturday nights.
Brad Paisley is not going to book the Opry to do a whole set, or is he?
He'll just come on and do a couple songs.
Right. That's what's amazing. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. And everybody contributes, right? It's not, they don't get paid.
The regular musicians don't?
The musicians, the backup, the guys in the back who are the musicians do, but the artists.
I was going to say, that sounds like a job. That doesn't
sound
like.
Yeah, that's their job. I mean, those guys have been there for 40 years.
Right, okay, yeah, yeah.
You know, so.
But if the privilege of singing at the Opry is not a paid privilege, it's a.
Correct.
Right.
Right. Yeah. You know, so, but he sang a song, dude, and it was so good and emotional people are crying. And it was so good and emotional. Like afterwards, it was almost that people didn't know how to respond.
Well, and you said it was a U2 song? Or
I believe it was a U2, one that we don't know though.
But that's what's amazing to me. So like everyone knows these songs, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of times you don't think about the lyrics, number one, because in the pop versions on the radio, not necessarily the lyrics aren't necessarily as they're not emphasizing the lyrics, right? So there's that, which I think he does masterfully well. But then there are some, I don't want to call them vocal theatrics because that makes it sound cheaper than it is. It's not theatrics. It is the sounds that he makes are connected to like the bottom of his soul and come out with power.
Yeah.
And skill and grace,
yeah, it's
that
great.
You feel like you are hearing you're hearing his soul make these sounds.
I know it's so crazy. So people didn't know what to do.
Yeah,
they were like, I'm crying. Should I clap now?" Then everybody kind of stood up.
Yeah.
And clapped because I don't think they were expecting it, you know?
Right.
And, but it was a great moment there because it was like, oh my gosh, this is unbelievable, you know, to be at the Opry and then to experience that. And then the crowd didn't know really what to do. And then people started clapping and standing up. And it was just, it was amazing.
Yeah.
So anyway, great guy. I'm glad he would spend some time with us today. And we're going on the road, buddy. Portland, Seattle is coming up soon.
Yeah, just
get ready. Ready to do your little dance?
Oh, dude, my dance!
I'm so ready.
Is
are you so ready,
ready.
Dude?
I'm oh
so
man,
ready.
That's so great. Yeah. These little teaser weekends are fun.
I know they are teasers,
but they are but it is a tease. It's like I want to live in this. I want to live in this for a bit.
I know, I totally do. But it's like I'm starting to write stuff for next year now.
Me too. Yeah,
for 2020 because we have to because it's coming right around the corner.
Yeah, it sure is.
So it's interesting, man, because you know, like. We don't have a way to test things.
No, we sure don't.
Right? So, and I'm not saying that we're comedians by any chance.
We surely are not.
But
even though I think I may have put that on my Twitter profile.
Yeah. I think you did on the Facebook. Comedians.
I'm making some living in comedy clubs. So does that, what does that equal? I don't know.
Well, yeah, but yeah, I mean.
Well, I introduce myself as one. Except
right.
Yeah.
But what we're trying to do is we're trying to take it seriously,
mm-hmm.
you know, because comedians are probably some of the hardest working people.
Well, absolutely.
That
well,
I know.
The thing is working specifically on our show, even it's, though it is a comedy show.
Yeah.
Feels more like writing material for our show does not feel like me constructing. I don't think I'm writing comedy. I'm looking for things that are hopefully going to be entertaining and fun for people.
Sure.
It doesn't equate to my, in my head to be like, oh, because I'm writing this stuff, that means I'm a comedian. And no, it just means I'm preparing for our show. I don't know.
Yeah. But you know, it's interesting because of listening to endless hours of podcasts and watching these endless hours of comedy specials. I mean, for the last 2 years now.
Yeah.
And to get to know everybody's process, which is right. similar but different.
Right.
But like Chris Rock had a bit that he said it took him 1 year to work the 6 minute bit out on stage. Right?
Yeah, we don't have that kind of time.
Well, that's the thing. That was the thing that I was saying. I'm like, we can't even like in Portland, Seattle, I might throw a few things in there right. just to see if they work.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Because we don't really have, like if I'm doing a regular 5 minutes just about life that has nothing to do with General Hospital, I can go down open mic night 2 or 3 nights a week and work that 5 minutes and see if it works and tweak it, change it, you know,
right.
delivery, inflection, word, whatever it right. is to make it funny. But we don't have the chance.
No, we sure don't.
To do it with what we do, right? Because right. we're 50 shows in. And we just felt like, oh, we're getting it.
Yeah.
Right. It's starting to work. Like every moment's kind of working now.
Right.
Because, you know, the first one we did when you did your interpretive dance and we were in Cincinnati. I mean, hey, God bless us for trying, dude. Right.
Right. I mean.
So we tried.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning of it, though.
That was the beginning.
And to see the evolution of where it's come yeah. is fascinating to me, just objectively looking like, wow, this is where they started.
Right.
With this guy dancing in a hoodie and a ski mask and cataract glasses.
Yep.
And then we play a video.
I know. That was great. I was like, this will be a good time suck. Here's a 6 minute video
of Bradford.
Well, I tried to make it funny.
I know. Well, you featured yourself a lot.
Multimedia.
Yeah.
So we're going for multimedia. Anyway, yeah,
we're having a blast and we're going sure to Portland, are. Seattle, and then we're going to
Detroit and Nashville.
And then the January dates are up, dude. They're up.
They are up, kids. StoneColdTheJackal.com/tour dates and appearances where you can just yes. click on that button.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got West Palm, Orlando, Tampa, Birmingham, Raleigh, and Richmond coming at you.
Yeah, buddy.
First week of January, 3 days after New Year's. You can sleep off New Year's Eve for 3 days and then come see our show.
And then it's going to be a party for a week.
Woo!
Whoop, whoop.
Yeah. So very exciting.
All right,
appreciate
man.
You all.
Yeah, we appreciate you guys. Thanks for listening. We
thanks to Jonathan. Thanks to you, Steve. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, buddy. Thank you, buddy.
Okay.
Have a good day, man.
Bye.
Later.
And don't forget next Wednesday, part 2 with Jonathan Jackson, including a sneak peek of his brand new single just for you guys. Hey friends, as always, a big thank you for listening to the show this week. We and the folks at Podcast One would like to ask you a small but very important favor. It'll only take a few minutes, and if you're one of the first people to do it, Podcast One will make it worth your time, literally. We'd love you to complete a short survey because the information you give us can help make things better for the show and for you as a listener. So just go to podcastone.com/survey and everything will be right there for you. That's podcastone.com/survey. And the first 250 people who complete the survey will get a $10 gift card to amazon.com, and 2 grand prize winners will be selected at random to get a $100 Amazon gift card. How about that? Free money. Not bad. As you may know, our shows are supported by advertisers, so filling this out will really help us cater to the needs of you as a listener. So please, please go to podcastone.com/survey, answer some questions, and potentially make some money along the way. Thank you all.
Imagine a world where animals and humans coexist in harmony, where wild animals thrive, habitats are protected, and marginalized communities are empowered. At International Animal Rescue, this is our vision. Our holistic, community-led projects not only rescue animals, but also protect and replenish precious habitats, creating a better future for us all. But we can't do this without you. Show your support now and help keep the wild wild. Visit internationalanimalrescue.org.